I'm Pamela Shaw from here at Northwestern. And the question can be answered by anyone, but it was spurred by a couple of things. First, that Ben and Nosh said. And that is that, Ben, you said that scientists are becoming more and more focused and more narrow. And so I was thinking about some things that people said this morning about vocabulary being hard to be shared. So as more people become focused and narrow in science, is it necessary to have the equivalent of, as Nosh mentioned in gaming, a priest on each team who can do the translation or the talking, the networking among scientists? Or should that be left to, say, the administrative center, for example, the CTSA in general, for those of us who have a CTSA? Should it be an individual on each team, or should it be a central organization who helps do that translating for people?
I think that's a really excellent question. And I think, you know, we see the rise of teams. We want to understand what's the right format of individuals that make a team effective. And this matters on many dimensions. One dimension is once you have a team, you want it to function. And you're focusing in on the issues of vocabulary and communication, which I think are very real. If people are pretty close together and have some overlap, maybe those hooks that allow them to communicate with each other are built in. But we might generally think that when they're farther apart and there might be real opportunities for collaboration, they just can't tap them because they just can't evaluate each other, what each other are saying. And even before you get to the fact that you have a team assembled and it functions poorly potentially, there's the issue of how do you even find these people in the first place? If someone's outside of my narrow social network, which is largely constituted within my field, I'm not even aware of those people. Nosh has got tools to help with that. But even once I might identify somebody, I'm quite comfortable evaluating the quality of people around me that I know in my field because I know their work. But if it's in an area which might really help me, but I don't know that area, how can I even evaluate if that's a good person, a bad person to work with? So there are great challenges. And it raises the question of whether we want, whether it's a priest or the MBA equivalent of scientists or, you know, a type of degree which is for someone who is not the deepest expert in any field but spans fields enough to both form social networks, they can identify participants and help them communicate, if you will, a manager of a team in some form. And that's not just in the team of science, it's in the evaluators at the NIH or the NSF or who have to pick grants. How do you evaluate ideas that are outside the boundaries of your study section at the NIH or if you're a patent examiner outside the boundaries of one person's knowledge? So I think that kind of role is really probably very critical to think about. I'd love to give you some facts about it, but I can't. Maybe Nosh has some facts he can share.
I know I don't have a fact, but I have an opinion. I think that, I really think that one of the skills, several years ago, a lot of accreditation boards in engineering and other fields asked students and the employers of students, what was the one thing that they were missing when they graduated from top engineering schools? And the number one complaint from employers were, well, these people are very good at doing differential calculus, but they're not very good communicators, and they don't work well on teams. I think we've reached another level at which we should say that in addition to helping with their communication skills, there is a collaboration fluency, if you want to call it that they need to have much more today than our generation did. Some of us are doing it better than others, but I think that that's a skill set that cannot rely on NIH or any central body to do it. It has to be a peer-to-peer organic skill sets that all of us as researchers, as being team scientists, need to develop those skills.
I also don't have facts, but I also have an opinion. About 5 years ago, NIH was running this workshop for creating centers for interdisciplinary research, and they asked me to give a talk on team science, and they also asked Eric Lander to give a talk, and it was very interesting. I mean, what he said was, I am the translator. I am the person that links these hundreds of people together. And so I would even actually make the other point that as we are becoming more and more specialized, it's not that Renaissance men and women should disappear, it's that they are becoming more and more essential and needed. And just like in many fields a while ago, there was this idea that if you have more than one co-author, there is the question about did that person did anything on the paper. Right now, we still have the criticism that that person is not deep, okay, which is sort of the killer comment. And not realizing that, well, you actually need someone that can bring together deep people from different specialties. And again, I think these will require cultural change.
I would add one thing to that. I think the high priests are really the graduate students and the postdocs. They are the ones on the ground that really bring faculty together who are from different fields. They invest heavily in a project. They invest heavily in the idea of combining fields. And they do a lot of the linchpin work that's necessary to keep interdisciplinary work going. And I think without them, it's really difficult to have successful collaborative interdisciplinary teams. And maybe the thing there to do in terms of policy is to begin creating more formal structures for students who actually get degrees and who have to work with faculty across different areas, or who would like to work with faculty across different areas, to really facilitate this.
Thank you.
The unsung heroes of collaborative work are truly the graduate students and the postdocs.
Hi, this is Griffin Weber from Harvard. My question can be for any of you. It's, what is the impact of this type of research that you're doing? Is it funding agencies that are reading in these papers in Nature and Science and looking at the web of science diagrams and changing how they allocate funds? Or is it researchers looking at this and realizing they need to form bigger groups to have more highly cited papers? I do similar kind of research, and people kind of want to know, why are they funding me for this kind of stuff? So what's the impact of this type of research on various parts of science?
I think one of the ideas is that if you understand how the science system works, then you can support it better. If you also, I mentioned this mirror before, if you look in this mirror and the patient looks dead or sick, then maybe you want to do something. But right now we don't have this kind of mirror. We don't really understand, or we don't know actually what's going on in science right now. And to have a real-time monitor of what is going on in science, to see emerging research areas, to see what new graduate students, where they'd go to, what jobs exist, what science news actually make it out into the general public, is one part. But then there's also a lot of theoretical part with work, which is very, very important to understand the laws and the inner dynamics of science. So I think you need both. I think you need this real-time mirror, which draws on multiple feeds of data, massive amounts of data. But at the same time, you also need quantitative and qualitative work with a lot of modeling to really understand why we have the structures we have and how can we get to the state we really wanted to have. And I think many of the funding agencies, if not all, they care deeply that the resources they have, be it a lot or a little, that they have a maximum impact. And every single funding agency out of the 200 we have in the US has a different criterion of what is good. Some deeply invest in cyber infrastructures, others deeply invest in people, others deeply invest in certain projects, mission-oriented research funding. And I think, therefore, they need very different views of the science and technology system. But there might be other answers also.
Yeah, so I'm an economist, so I'll take the dismal science approach to answering that question. But actually, let me be a bit grandiose for a second even. Because to an economist, the signature feature of the modern age since the Industrial Revolution is rapid technological progress. And that brings lots of benefits. I mean, you can be interested in science because we like discovery and curiosity, but it also brings health and longevity and gooder standards of living and less child mortality and a lot of other things. So I would say there's a production function for knowledge. You put in time, you put in money. So there's researchers putting in their time. There's public dollars being put in as money. And you want to make that thing efficient. So I think the stakes here are critical to prosperity, and I think it's very important to get this right so we can get the most bang for our dollar and bang for our hour.
Continuing my opinionated opinions, I have given talks about many of these aspects in broader audiences, and it's not, maybe you will not be surprised that many scientists take them very poorly. They tell, it's sort of, you study things, but you don't like to be the object of study. But I think the way to look at this is the exact same way that we look at the Framingham Heart study. You know, it's sort of, we know that saturated fats are bad for you, but we are not forcing you not to eat them, right? It's sort of the same thing. We are going to find out about what are things that could make you a better scientist, but we are not going to force you to do them. So I think you still have your freedom of choice, but just like it's useful for me to know that eating vegetables is good, maybe it's good for me to know that, you know, collaborating with someone new from time to time will be good for me too. So
I think there are in fact, I sort of counted up in my mind at least four stakeholder communities that I think benefits from the kind of research we've talked about here. First, I think it's the researcher themselves to help navigate them to find the collaboration partners. This is sort of the Love Getty Sniff idea. How do you find the right person you want to do? So that's one stakeholder, the actual researcher. The second is the person who is managing a large research project, maybe a PI of a center, et cetera. And these are people who look at it to get a lay of the land to see where there are opportunities or structural holes that could be filled, what are the kinds of new collaborations that should happen if only Northwestern or if only knew what NewCATS knows, that kind of stuff, to be able to see from that top level. A third stakeholder would be the funding agencies, and Kati and others have spoken about that. So they are the ones who are looking at investment portfolio and seeing which areas need to be invested in, where you want to provide incentives for new connections to be built. And the fourth stakeholder, which the funding agencies have impressed upon me more than anyone else, is Congress or the public in general. And that is the fact that when we get funding from NSF, one of the things they want us to send them on a regular basis are small nuggets or ingots or whatever is the latest term that they use for it, which they then sell to Congress, which, as the representatives of the people, make it more palatable for them to digest some of the research that otherwise they might find esoteric. So I think those are four stakeholders that come to my mind.
Hi, Jack Teebs from the Yale Medical School. There's a distinction between science that's done in teams and team science. The latter, you have distributed leadership, and science that's done in teams may have distributed leadership, but more likely it's a PI who has a team, and it's his or her team. When you do bibliometric analyses, how do you make that distinction between those two kinds of doing science?
I mean, one of the ways that you could do it would be looking at the departments of the people that are doing the paper. You could look at addresses if they are located at different institutions. So it's never absolutely sure that you can clear that out. And for data further in the past, it is harder because many of the databases do not contain affiliation information. But there are ways in which you can get at that.
The follow-up is, do we run a risk of creating theory based on bibliometric analyses without some kind of distinction between the science that involves distributed leadership versus science that has large-scale kind of siloed teams where you have a PI carrying out a lot of work?
Broadly speaking, we definitely want to unpack as finely as possible which teams are successful, what formats work, which ones don't. And one piece of evidence to be less opinionated, more fact-oriented for a second, which we can interpret, coming back to Brian's presentation, is that if you look at where a lot of the team growth is, a lot of it's multi-university. So that's not exactly the distinction you're saying, but it maps probably fairly closely to it. And we see that, in fact, that is particularly both the growth spot and the source of the relatively highest impact stuff.
Yeah, one last thing on that. When we looked at multi-university teams versus teams at the same university, we did a supplemental analysis where we also included research institutes, which brings it closer to the second kind of group that you're talking about. And when we included those in the analysis, what you found was that the growth of multi-university teams was even faster than what I showed today, but it did not change the underlying effect of multi-university teams. So it may be that although these two types of teams are different, on a fundamental level, their relationship to the production of high-impact science is quite similar.
Hi, my name is Maritza Salazar. I'm a postdoc at the University of Central Florida. And I think that this conference has been really great because we are taking different methodological perspectives on the same phenomenon. And my question has to do with, I appreciate network research and that it gives us a snapshot, a structural picture of different kinds of teams and then their outcomes. But then a couple of hours ago, we were hearing about barriers to integrating information using communication. We know from our work in social psychology that our biases to want to be with people like us keep us from crossing boundaries. And I'm curious to ask you, where is network research going in terms of picking up dynamic aspects of predictors of structures, how structures change, perhaps drawing on some of the micro aspects that colleagues in the same room talked about only a little while ago.
I think in terms of network research, outside of the study of scientists, there's already a pretty well-developed body of knowledge of on how networks develop for other types of fields and sectors. Creative arts has got some. There's a lot on business people, how these change over time, why, how do people select themselves into different networks, and the ultimate impact of those networks on individuals. I think a lot of what we're going to see in science will borrow from that already existing body of knowledge to first help us inform what's going on. And I think what we'll find as well is that some people do it well and some people don't, and that's going to be the difference in some of these teams' effects. And then how do you raise the entire tide so that people are able to learn from best practices is one going to be having people become more aware of the value of team science and also to build in skills that can help them do teams better. Mm-hmm. That'll probably start at the top, so the people who run big teams and research institutes are going to want to go out and learn practice of team leadership. Those skills, in turn, could be passed down to their students, something related to what Luis talked about today. And in that way, we'll begin to see these ideas come into science, both to alert us as to better ways to do the production of science and also to gain the skills to do it.
Well, let me make my question more narrow. We know that information, there's content of networks, there's the nature of the relationship between ties in a network. Could you see us mapping on maybe a, you know, looking at flows of information more technically based on who shares what with who, creativity networks that get to content, or measures of social cycle in-group, out-group bias measures tied to network? I mean, could we go there, I guess, is what I'm asking with your methodologies.
I think we have gone there. And that's I mean that in the best sense of the term. I mean, if you look at several of the small group research community, many of the leaders of which are represented in this room right now, and much of the research that is presented in conferences like In Group, that is published in places like Small Group Research, that is published in edited volumes, ones that Scott Poole, for example, have been involved in, have recognized that advancing our understanding of groups/teams has to be multifaceted and come from different methodological approaches. Mm-hmm. So, for example, if you take things like transactive memory, which is one particular theory that has been, and there are several in the room who are experts at this. This is an example of how you differentiate knowledge, that good teams have different people of different levels of expertise and some shared knowledge. There's a huge body of literature in social psychology that looks at teams and transactive memory within teams. There is a small amount of knowledge that is actually trying to take a network formulation of that. Mm-hmm. And so that's an example of the kind of research that makes me encouraged about the fact that there is already that cross-fertilization between traditional social psychology approaches as well as network formulations and in the reverse direction. Mm-hmm. So the kind of research that you're describing, I think, is not only there, but I think it represents the potential of growth. Yeah. And frankly, I think that the panelists here, while we've been sort of focusing on pitching the network aspect of it, I think much of our work actually is informed by and does engage with the broader enterprise of studying teams.
Yeah, and I would add to that, you know, Luis was saying he wasn't going to force anybody to eat their vegetables because we all like being, you know, freelancers. That's one of the things that attracts us to this field. But there's thousands upon thousands of scientists in organizations all around the world. So Procter & Gamble's got 8,000 research scientists scattered around the globe. They're told to eat their vegetables in that kind of organization. And places like Procter & Gamble, Procter & Gamble and Kraft and Goldman Sachs and lots of other organizations are already at the vanguard of experimenting with these tools, using different ways to manage content and look at Twitter feeds and a whole range of other things to understand what's the best way to organize their teams through time. That's going to be an awfully great experiment for the rest of us to watch in terms of what best practices are.
Thank you very much.
Alan Porter, Georgia Tech. A quick gestalt first and then a question. The panel, interesting flavor, because we started with the warning of the explosion of scientific information, suggesting team science is important. But I think when we put it together, another solution comes forth, which is information science. In Kadi's visual wrap-up sort of She says, yeah, there's some really magnificent ways visually and analytically to mine that information. And just to mention one triggered by all this, pursued by a colleague, Ron Kostoff, literature-based discovery is really intriguing. The idea of trying to ferret out some of these indirect connections beyond what that typical researcher concentrating on the immediate vegetables would reach out for can be pretty marvelous, not exploited much yet. Specific question to Brian. We've gotten intrigued by trying to ferret out whether a piece of research is drawing on previously separate research streams. Mm-hmm. So interested in how you measure the conventional versus the avant-garde. Is it a percent of researches that have been co-cited mm-hmm. within that same paper, or?
Great question. I wasn't able to get to that in the talk. And I could say two things. One, some of the original work in this area was done by someone in this room that's named Small, very important contribution to how we do things. And I mentioned a little bit earlier that one of the great unsung heroes of all of this work is the postdoc. And Mike Stringer, who's also in the room, did a lot of the coding and the analysis on this. And Mike, I'd like to invite you to respond. Do you want to take the stage for a minute and explain what you did? Because it's really a great insight. Mike doesn't always take the shortest path.
So it's a really great question. And actually, we draw a lot on your work in figuring out how to do that. So. The basic idea is that we create a co-citation network. A paper cites several journals. So maybe a physics paper cites Physical Review Letters, Physica A, and typically cites a bunch of physics journals. And we look at when those journals are cited together by one paper. And if Physical Review Letters is cited in the same reference list as Physica A, then you suspect that those journals are related. So that's a co-citation network. And you can do that for each year, drop a gigantic co-citation network of all the papers in the Web of Science. And on top of that, we wanted to try to control for the fact that some journals are cited more often than others. So Nature gets co-cited with a lot of journals just because it's cited an awful lot. So what we did is we just randomized the citation network, but kept the citations to all the journals constant, as well as keeping the citation dynamics to all the journals constant, and built up a series of random networks and said, well, how often is Nature cited with PRL? How much more often than expected by chance? And so that's how we say that this journal has been combined more often than you would expect by chance. So we can talk about it more later afterwards too.
Short answer, wow.